D-Mace, Finnegan, and Donick, 102.5, 106.3, the game. Broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. And we are presented by Bet365. Whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan joined on our phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, by ESPN NFL analyst Tim Hasselbeck. Tim, Willie and I spent much of the previous hour talking about Derek Carr's sudden retirement and the fallout of that, specifically for the New Orleans Saints. Tyler Shuck now has the inside track to start for the Saints, although Spencer Rattler and Jake Haener are there. What I'm curious for you, we didn't talk a lot about Tyler Shuck with you just because he wasn't someone who was on the Titans' radar, but what are your thoughts on Tyler Shuck and how ready he could be to start for the Saints in week one if it came to that?
Yeah, I loved him coming out. You know, his path was, you know, kind of unique. And I think because he was injured and so he bounced around and, there was so much change for him. And some of it was just, and I think that's the case with a lot of these guys now that are transferring their multiple spots. But like, you know, his seemed like it was transferring multiple spots. Like, why was he leaving? There were other guys that were replacing him that were good. What was it? I will say, I'd never called a Louisville game when he was there as Louisville's quarterback, but talked to that coaching staff prior to the Senior Bowl. And, you know, basically, and those guys have been around a lot of good quarterbacks, either their time in Purdue or time, you know, at Louisville. And, you know, they're basically like, look, this guy is going to tear it up. Like, he's an NFL player. And the reason you say that is he has the size, he has the arm strength, he has really good athleticism for a guy that is that size and has that arm strength. And, you know, I do think his pass was a little bit choppy, which, probably impacted the way some people thought about him going into the draft process. But then once people got a chance to sit down and talk to him, see what he knew, and then also evaluate the physical side of things, he just was really, really impressive. So I liked him a lot. I actually think that, you know, he's kind of going into this situation flying under the radar a little bit. And with him, you know, kind of flying under the radar and now walking in a situation where, look, he's going to be the day one starter. You know, I'm not sure what the expectations are, but they're probably not as high as they are for Cam Ward or as they are for Jackson Dart or they are for some of these other guys. I think he finds himself in a really good situation with an outstanding play caller as his head coach.
How should we remember Derek Carr's career?
I can tell you how I'm going to remember it. And I'm going to remember it this way. I thought that he was playing really, really well early in his career and suffered a brutal leg injury late in the season, you know, sort of getting around contract time, if I remember correctly. And then he finds himself on kind of one of these, you know, starter, non-starter contracts in Las Vegas. And everything in Las Vegas is falling apart, everything. The coach is getting fired because of emails that he sent. The star receiver is, you know, spending time in prison because of a drunk driving accident. And Derek Carr's leadership for that organization at that time, when there was all kinds of stuff that was going on inside the organization that, you know, you typically don't ask your quarterback to lead through. I thought Derek Carr did as good a job as you could possibly do leading through that time. So, like, I'm actually going to remember him as a guy that was a really good quarterback, but, like, the way his character showed through in, like, these really dark times for the Raiders, he impressed me through that about as much as you could impress somebody.
Tim, Willie and I have had a couple of laughs about the overreaction that tends to come out of rookie mini camps around the NFL. It's not just here in Tennessee with Cam Ward. It's all over the NFL world. And teams put out those slickly produced videos on social media of the passes from the quarterback to the top rookie receiver, and everybody gets excited. We saw that here with Cam Ward.
X team might have found a long-term backup QB in UDFA, you know, that or backup cornerback, or a diamond in the rough at wide receiver.
Right.
These are what you see in May.
I saw a quote tweet from a Titans video. It was a clip of Cam Ward throwing to Xavier Restrepo. And a Titans fan quote tweeted it and said, 1,000-yard season incoming, I presume, for – I hope it's a 1,000-yard season for Xavier Restrepo, because if Cam Ward throws for 1,000 yards, we've got problems. But I'm curious for your opinion about how much can we actually take away from Cam Ward at rookie minicamp.
I don't think you can take much away from it at all. I really don't. Like, you don't even have your whole team there. And so you're right. Like, these, you know, slickly produced videos, or, you know, a beat reporter or team reporter being like, hey, you know, 14 of 15 today, and that one incompletion was a drop. You know, like, I don't think it means anything when you're just getting that little sample size. Now, I will say this, and I've said this before on this show. Like, there are times when you get to the first mini camp and everybody's there, where, like, you'll have some veterans that maybe, like, a guy got drafted at your position, and you know right away, you're like, nope, this guy's not going to take my job, you know? And sometimes you know right away, like, yep, like, that guy's a dude. Like, that guy, he's gonna help us. He's gonna be a problem. Like, I'll never forget. Like, we were at the Giants one year, and I remember we threw with some young receivers that were drafted, and, you know, one was drafted higher than the other, and we threw one time. I just remember walking off the field with Eli, and it was just like, we knew right away that the kid drafted later was actually better than the kid who was drafted earlier. He just was, like, and you knew. And, like, you almost were like, I'm not sure what the scouting department saw. Like, because, like, we just, you know, we threw for 35 minutes and we figured it out. So, look, I do think that when everyone's together, you can start to get a sense. I think that's one of the reasons why you'll see some of the veteran free agent signings after, like, the full, you know, mini camp when veterans are there. But I think these early on rookie mini camps with mostly guys that are not going to make the team, I think there's almost nothing you can learn from them.
Tim Hasselbeck is with us. We're talking NFL football with him. Here's a headline from the ESPN page at this time of the year, where you get this kind of content, a lot of rookie camps going on. This is out of the Jaguars camp. Why Travis Hunter is ready to become NFL star as first full-time two-way player in 60 years. Now, It's a really interesting. I'm not sure. I haven't read the article, so I haven't heard the case. But I would love your opinion on it, Tim, because I remember this being built up with Shohei Ohtani, who was at a different stage of his career when he came over, right, and was a two-way player in baseball. But the question was, can you do it? And I remember a longtime reliever who we used to talk to a lot, who was from this area, David Weathers, who pitched forever in Major League Baseball. He said, I don't think it can be done. I don't think you can play a position and pitch. And he was sort of right, because Ohtani has done it, but with a cost, right? He hasn't been able to do it for a long time. So I guess that's my question with Hunter, is there's no doubt that if you put him out there for a while, he will be a full-time two-way player. But what's the practicality of doing it long-term?
So there's a couple of things here that are striking me in this. First off, like the hype train that you just, you know, read in the headline, okay,
right.
The hype train. I'm feeling slighted by the show right now. But, like, I feel like you guys should be tweeting stuff out, releasing, you know, press releases, you know, Ensworth, you know, high school football coach and ESPN NFL analyst, like, and it's like hyping me up for, like, the two jobs that I have.
Okay? Yes,
like,
you're a two-way, like, you're a multifaceted guy. Yeah.
Yeah, like, can he sustain this, you know, for, you know, year over year?
Tim,
like,
Hasselbeck, renaissance man.
I mean, I don't.
Hasselbeck feeling the effects of burnout with this extra load, like, that he's carrying.
I do. I feel like you guys are not, promoting me as much as Travis Hunter is getting promoted. And honestly, I feel slighted.
Okay.
We'll take that under advisement.
Yes, we'll get a new marketing campaign pronto.
As soon as I'm off this, I'm calling Chase to be like, hey, man, like,
we need to hype this up.
Friends treat each other. here's where I think, Willie, it's going to get tricky for Hunter. Is they're not going to pay him as a receiver and a defensive back. And so, you know, it's no different. Like, look, we've seen Jalen Ramsey. Jalen Ramsey has been one of the best corners in the NFL. Well, now he's moving to safety. He's trying to elongate his career to maximize his earning potential as a player in the National Football League. And so, look, when you play 60 snaps a game, that's very different than playing 80 snaps a game. It just is. Over time, when you're playing a 17 and who knows, maybe an 18-game season and all of that stuff. And so as you're Travis Hunter and you look at it and you go, wait a minute, okay, so let's say he's a receiver. I'm getting paid as one of the elite receivers in the NFL, but I'm playing 45 snaps a game more than that other guy, and the average NFL career is 3 years. Like, what am I doing? Like, yes, I can do this, but is it really worth it? Look, Champ Bailey, if he wanted to, could have been played corner and receiver. He's a teammate of mine in Washington, and oh my word, like, he was unbelievable. And he did play some offensive snaps, but it wasn't many. And so, you know, I guess I would just say that, like, can he do it? Yeah, he probably can do it for a little while, but he's going to end up looking at it and say, is this really the best deal? And, you know, Will, you know this, especially in baseball. Think about the guys that, like, hey, they were catchers, right? But, hey, let's get him, you know, out from behind the dish there,
right,
so that he can play longer. It's really no different than that. And I think ultimately that will, you know, outweigh the idea of playing on both sides of the ball.
You know, you mentioned the contractual part of it, which does come into play, like what the franchise tag is and for one position, mm-hmm, as opposed to another. And that might cloud things too. But I do wonder, as they move forward, can they be on the same page as, okay, Travis, this is the best way for you to be effective and for us to get the most value out of you, even if it's not the ideal thing that you envision, which you've been your whole career, which is you play every snap.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would just say this. Like, I think it's much easier to be a defensive starter and then have a small menu of plays as an offensive player. I think it's much easier to do that. I think it's much more difficult to be a full-time offensive player and then learn what you need to learn on defense. Because when you call an offensive play, like, you're dictating it. You know what it is. So you know when you break the huddle, like, you know what you're doing. You might have a route adjustment based on the coverage or something like that. But, you know, if you call a defensive play, like, you have no idea the formation that they're going to get into, the motion that they're going to get into. Like, and so now just the communication and adjustment that it takes to play on the defensive side of the ball, I think is just, it's too much, unless you're going to be very basic when that guy's in on defense. So I think there are other challenges to this that are different than doing it in college. But look, just like Jimmy Graham, when he was up and they were, the Saints at the time were trying to franchise him as a tight end. And he's like, wait a minute, guys, I play more snaps outside the numbers than I do as an inline tight end. So if you're going to franchise me, you're franchising me as a wide receiver. Well, like, you know, they got into, you know, kind of a big battle on that. Well, what if the franchise numbers are very different for the, you know, the corners and the receivers? And if that's the case, then Travis, the desire to be this two-way player is going to go away.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm looking forward to it, but I think that, especially with the Jaguars in the same division as the Titans, we're going to be watching closely to see, mm-hmm, how this plays out. Meanwhile, Tim, the Steelers, I'm curious, if you're in their camp, what do you think's going through their mind right now as to how to play their cards? We just, in our last segment before you came on, we're talking about Kirk Cousins and how he kind of would love to maybe be on mm-hmm, the free agent market so he could maybe pick and choose where to go rather than to sit there and wait and the Falcons hold on to him. You've got the Aaron Rodgers drama it's always out there. What do you think the Steelers are thinking right now?
I think that the Steelers, now, I'm not reporting this is what I think. I think the Steelers know that Aaron Rodgers is playing. And I think the Steelers are in full anticipation that he'll be their quarterback. I'm not reporting that, but here's why I think that. We joked about it, I believe, last week or 2 weeks ago. 40-something-year-old quarterbacks don't put cleats on and go throw if they're done playing. You're done doing it. You don't do that. And so, you know, Aaron Rodgers has visited Pittsburgh, spent time with Mike Tomlin. You know, I think there had to be a conversation where it's like, look, you guys don't draft a quarterback in the first or second round. You know, I will come play for you guys in that type of environment. And, you know, this is how I like to spend my off season, but when it comes down to it, I'll be there. Again, not reporting that, but I think that gave the Pittsburgh Steelers the confidence to go through the draft and not draft a quarterback. I really don't think Kirk Cousins is the option there because, you know, you would have to eat a bunch of his contract. Kirk would have to waive a no-trade clause. I think it's just way too complicated to have the Kirk Cousins thing work out there. And so I agree with you that Kirk would much rather go be a starter somewhere, but I think it's too difficult to make it happen. I think what's easy is Aaron Rodgers on a one-year deal. Like that's what I think is easy. And I think that happens the closer we get to the summertime. So are you nervous if you're Pittsburgh? Yeah, you're probably a little nervous, but you probably have some pretty good confidence based on, you know, Aaron throwing with DK Metcalf, you know, in California and the conversation that Mike Tomlin was able to have with Aaron Rodgers, that he's going to end up in a Steelers uniform this year.
All right. Final follow-up on this, because the Titans have gone through it. The Saints now, with the Carr news, are forced to almost have no choice but to go into rebuilding mode for a while. And you could argue that they probably should have done it sooner than now. Just like you could have argued a couple years ago when Mike Vrabel was telling everybody, you don't rebuild in the NFL. And he was saying, hey, look at this division. We can win this division. Let's hang on with Tannehill and et cetera. We can maybe make one more run. I think the Steelers are kind of in that mode. They play in a really tough division. So much has been made that they've not had a losing record. But what's best case with Rodgers? And would they be almost better off just taking the step back to take the two steps forward?
Yeah, they may, but I don't know that. I don't know that Rodgers, you know, doesn't help them ultimately get there. Does that make sense? Like, from a standpoint of, you know, you're not mortgaging your future because Aaron Rodgers is your quarterback this year. You know, on a 1 year, who knows what it is? You know, a 1 year, $40 million deal. Like, I'm not saying that's what it is, but like, I don't know that mortgages your future. I think Dallas's situation is much more in line with, oh, do you really want to double down on this in Dallas with that contract and the fact that you're going to have him for years? So, I think you can try to be competitive with Rodgers and the guys that you have right now. And, you know, kind of like the scenario you're explaining with, you know, the Titans and Ryan Tannehill. But I also don't think that prevents you from, you know, a year from now drafting a quarterback and saying like, hey, we're starting over and it's okay. We still feel good about our roster. Because I don't think it'll be a long-term commitment to Rodgers, which is why I actually think it makes a little bit of sense for Pittsburgh. And I think it makes sense for Rodgers because it's his only place to be a starter. And look, we've talked about Bo Nix, you know, on NFL Live. You know, last year, I'm actually talking about him again on NFL Live today. Like, he threw 29 touchdown passes last year. We probably would all agree Bo Nix had a fantastic rookie year. Fair? Like, did I say that? Aaron Rodgers threw 28 touchdowns last year. So, you know, I do think sometimes, like, all right, if Pittsburgh can get almost 30 touchdowns and fewer than 10 interceptions out of Aaron Rodgers, they might win 11 games. So I understand it from Pittsburgh's perspective.
Tim Hasselbeck, ESPN NFL analyst, head coach of the Ensworth Tigers. Dual threat. triple threat, perhaps, if you have another hidden talent that we need to know
about.
The
first media slash coach star in 60 years in Nashville.
Generational, some would say.
I mean, can we get the headlines, please? I mean, let's
We're just workshopping this now. The billboards will be up around town very soon.
You know what? So we'll do like a little like photo shoot so we can go on Instagram and stuff too.
Yes,
like
we definitely need a graphics design person.
Yeah,
yes.
That goes with it. Okay. I'm like, well, look, I will say I was at the Savannah Bananas the other night. What night was that? Saturday night?
Yes.
And I did see Cam Ward. It was quite the ovation for Cam Ward when he got introduced to the huge crowd at Nissan. So,
was that the first time you'd ever been to a Savannah? I've never been to a Savannah Bananas.
Hey, listen to this.
Were you thumbs up on this?
So first time, definitely thumbs up on this, and I'm not making this up. So Elizabeth and I, we go with our two boys. And so the way it works is, like, somebody hits a foul ball. If you catch it, then the batter's out.
Right.
So we're kind of behind the net on the first baseline. But a foul ball comes to us, and my son Taylor catches the foul ball. And so we're like, so the batter's out. So I'm like, oh, okay, wait a second. Then he ends up in the dugout, like with the team, because he's in the.
So I'm like, because he's on the score sheet now. He recorded it out. Hey, he gets the put out.
Hey, so listen, it was a good experience prior to that. It was even a better experience once, you know, my son catches a foul ball for an out and ends up in the dugout. So it was great. It was really great.
Very cool. Tim Hasselbeck, ESPN NFL analyst. What can't this guy do? He joins us every week on the program. Tim, great stuff. We'll
talk
next
week. Could have got the foul ball. You know, his son beat him to it. Yeah, too slow.
It's fair. He reached up over me and caught it. It's kind of embarrassing.
Thanks, Tim.
Good call. See you, fellas.
Tim Hasselbeck on the program. 615-737-1025. Coming up next, what are some lessons the Predators can learn from the remaining teams in the Stanley Cup playoffs? We'll discuss that next. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025, 1063 The Game. D-Mace Vingan and Donick, 1025, 1063 The Game. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan here with you. The Stanley Cup playoffs continue tonight. Only one game in the NHL tonight. Jets at Stars. Miro Heiskanen is expected to return to the Stars lineup tonight. They're up 2-1 in the series, if I'm not mistaken. So the Stars looking to go up 3-1 on the Jets with their star defenseman re-entering the lineup after being out since, what, January?
More or less, yes. He did not play in the Four Nations face-off. That was in February, so I believe that's right. He's been out since January.
It's been a minute since we've seen Miro Heiskanen, and the Stars will look to take a 3-1 lead at home in the series against the Winnipeg Jets.
And if you're not familiar with their roster, it's a very balanced roster. If you are a hockey fan,
if you're a Predators fan, you see it five times a year.
Yes, and if you're a Predator fan, you know that has been a discussion that we've had the last 2 or 3 years, is how things have worked out really well for Dallas in a number of ways. They have a very balanced roster, and it's been put together in a unique way. They did not have to tank and have to be bad for a long time to build what looks like a championship roster this year. They haven't won it. But if you look at the last few years, they've been in the mix, and they've done so without having to have the top five pick in the draft year in and year out. Heiskanen is the only guy in recent times, right? That was a top five pick, and they won the lottery to move up several spots, kind of like Utah did. They didn't hit, he wasn't the first pick, but they moved up from sort of a mediocre spot to get him. But other than that, they've hit on a lot of lower first-round picks and non-first-round picks that we've talked about.
So what lessons can the Predators learn from the team still playing in the Stanley Cup playoffs? There are two that come to mind, and I think one of them Willie and I might disagree on. The first is, it's a star-driven league at this point. You look at the players making an impact on a nightly basis for these teams. I know it's easy to just go to the point leaders, but Mikko Rantanen, who is the prime example of this. Connor McDavid, William Nylander, Leon Draisaitl, Kyle Connor. They're making a difference. The Predators desperately need that type of player. Now, the way you get that type of player is by getting the number one or number two pick in the NHL draft, which the Predators unfortunately did not get this time around. But Rantanen, to me, Willie, is the prime example because a lot of you know the story. Rantanen played for the Avalanche for several years, was Nathan McKinnon's trusty line mate, put up huge numbers. They could not agree to a contract. They trade him to the Carolina Hurricanes. It's reported that Rantanen doesn't want to sign long-term with the Hurricanes. So what, less than 2 months after arriving in Raleigh, he's off to Dallas. And he has been outstanding in these playoffs. The Colorado Avalanche have plenty of stars. Nathan McKinnon, Cale Makar. I bet they wish they still had Mikko Rantanen, another star on that team. And the Avalanche, they prioritize depth. When they traded Rantanen, they got Marty Natchez, they got Jack Drury, they traded for Brock Nelson at the deadline. And depth is good, but you need those top-of-the-line players to succeed in the Stanley Cup playoffs, which the Predators, unfortunately, do not have. So it's not a lesson that is easy to take, but it's one thing that stands out to me so far about these playoffs.
Yes. I think that's always going to be the case. I think the Predators' star power can change year in and year out. But the thing that jumps out at me more than anything else is the teams that are left can all defend. And they can really dig in and suppress offense from the other team. And that's how you counteract the star power to some degree. And the teams that are left all excel in team defense. And goaltending is a part of that, but I'm looking a little bit more at the defensive structure. And it doesn't mean that you're doing this at the expense of offense, because the best teams can score, but they can also defend. But I think the defending part is a little underrated. I'm looking at the SportLogic graph of expected goals against. And I see Winnipeg, I see Florida, I see Vegas, I see Edmonton. Edmonton is not known for defense. They're certainly not known for goaltending. But the reality is they play pretty good team defense in terms of expected goals against. And I think when they need to defend, especially in the playoffs, they know how to sort of hunker down and get the defense that they're looking for.
Five of the top 10 teams in the regular season in expected goals against per game are still alive in the playoffs. Vegas, Florida, Edmonton, Winnipeg, and Carolina.
Carolina is one that I didn't mention, but yes, Carolina would probably be the one team that lacks the star power that you're talking about, right?
Yes.
But their team analytics are very good. Yes.
They're
on the verge of knocking out the number one seed.
What's
the
saying? They're greater than the sum of their parts?
Yes.
That is what the Carolina Hurricanes are. Here is how I would counteract that point about defense. Because the old adage is defense wins championships,
yes,
right?
And I subscribe to that.
And the Predators absolutely need to improve defensively. A lot of the attention, understandably, on the Predators this season was their inability to score because
which
of
was glaring.
Steven Stamkos and Jonathan Marchessault coming in 240 goal scorers. I've said this multiple times. The Predators were the first team in NHL history to acquire 240 goal scorers in the same offseason, meaning players who scored 40 goals the previous season, not players who had scored 40 goals in their careers at some point. But defensively, that drop-off was just as glaring. It went sort of under the radar, I think, because of how bad it was on the offensive end. But I did find this to be interesting, Willie. The first round averaged 6.5 goals per game, the second highest total in any opening round in the past 30 years, behind 1995, which was 6.8 goals per game. So I do think that defense is important. However, I do think that being able to score and being able to score in different ways and being able to score in high-pressure situations is just as vital. I think it might be taking a little bit more importance than maybe defensive play.
I think the easy answer is that you have to have both. I think part of what we're saying, one thing that has stood out to me is power plays, right? The power play is converting as a league at a higher rate than it has in a long, long time, something like 30 or 40 years. So that's a big element, is that the that I think is common. You do not want to commit a penalty when you're playing the Oilers, the Maple Leafs, the Panthers. Like, they have deadly power plays. So that's part of it too. And that's how maybe how the goal scoring is up a little bit more, is the percentage of conversion of the power plays. It's just so hard to stop those right now. And we're sort of leaving out a very important part, and that is, who's your goalie? Is your goalie going to be able to withstand the barrage of these high-skilled teams? So I think you're making a good point, Adam, but I think the offense jumps out at you. It's the headliner, but I think it sometimes sort of has you overlooking how well these teams defend to contain a Draisaitl, a McDavid, a MacKinnon. Like, if you don't have it together against those teams, they will light you up. And in the playoffs, I think that, you know, we haven't seen a lot of super high-scoring games. Although, you're right, there's more goal scoring, but that's why I think the product is so good. They are finding a way to score. But I think you look up sometimes, the shots are something like 22 to 18 sometimes.
But the quality is
up. Quality, yeah, I guess right. I guess that's a fair thing.
Right, the shots are down. I think just the shot counter you see on the scoreboard, I feel like that is down, but the quality of opportunities is up, except if you're the Carolina Hurricanes, who just shoot the puck from everywhere.
They're a little in a different school. They're about the volume.
They're the old school. They're more volume than quality.
You're right. That is something that if you listen closely and you pay attention, that is a trend right now, is teams are more selective on how they shoot. They're not just going to, quote, warm up the goalie with long shots. The exception is Carolina, where they just want to flood so many shots, even if they're not quality.
Look for rebounds, towards the net, second chance opportunities.
Somewhere in there, they're going to get a bounce. And it's working for them right now.
Yeah, they're up 3-1 on the Washington Capitals. So we will keep an eye on the Stanley Cup playoffs. What lessons do you think the Predators should take away from the Stanley Cup playoffs?
But let's talk about the Predators' defense right now and how far they are. I think that was a telling part. Again, overshadowed by the fact that they couldn't score. But my theory is, if they could fix the defensive part of their game and give more, like, this is the adage that Chris Mason says all the time about goaltending. If you are predictable, if your defense can be whatever way you choose to defend, if it's predictable and your goalie knows where the shots are going to come from, that is a way that you succeed. And I do think UC Saros is just as good as he's ever been. I do not believe in the theory that he's aging or he's not as good as he used to be. I think it's much more about how they play in front of him. If they can be consistent, I think he is a guy that can still elevate, kind of like Connor Hellebuyck elevates the Jets. Except on the road in the playoffs. And look, this is always the question with all the goalies, is can you get it done in the postseason? But it certainly helps if you can be consistent with your structure in front. But that, to me, was the biggest reason why the team completely flopped. The goal scoring was secondary to me.
Quickly, I just want to list the goalies, the starting goalies for the teams that are still alive in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Connor Hellebuyck in Winnipeg, Jay Gottinger in Dallas, Sergei Bobrovsky in Florida, Joseph Woll is starting for the Maple Leafs because Anthony Stolarz is injured. Stuart Skinner was pulled in Edmonton for Calvin Pickard, who is now injured, and now they're back to Stuart Skinner. Vegas has Aiden Hill. Carolina has Freddie Anderson. Washington has Logan Thompson. Are there any themes you're picking up on the types of goalies that are still alive in the playoffs?
It's mixed. There are some teams that have the high-paid goalie. Bobrovsky, Ottinger, Hellebuyck would be that category. I would say that Vegas and now Washington have identified that these guys are pretty important and paid them a decent amount. Not in the stratosphere of Vezina Trophy
Aiden
winners.
Hill and Logan Thompson.
Right. Those
who
guys
were teammates in Vegas.
Yes. They were. Yes. That's the weird part about it. But they are guys that have earned the next contract at a pretty good raise. They're not just taken off the street. And I would imagine that Joseph Wohl is going that direction. I think Stolarz is probably earning himself. Did he sign a one-year deal with Toronto?
I can't recall what the contract was, but he was really good in limited playing time for the Panthers last season. So he was actually quite good for the Maple Leafs this season. So
the Oilers are the outlier to me. Who they have just not they have been stuck with these two guys. And I think if there was any way they could upgrade, they would have.
Yeah, Pickard won all of those games for Edmonton after he replaced.
I don't
Skinner,
know how he. I honestly don't know how
his numbers were not good.
I don't know how he does it, honestly, but I give him credit for being about as good as he can be. But he's still the Achilles heel. And the same thing is true with Skinner. Those are the guys that have everybody holding their breath. If they had the lights-out goalie, I think the Oilers would have won two cups by now. Do you agree with that theory?
It certainly wouldn't hurt. 615-737-1025. We'll take your thoughts on what lessons you think the Predators should learn from the remaining teams in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And we will wrap up the show coming up next. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025, 1063, the game.
I'm not saying these lotteries were rigged. But if we ever found out 60 years later that a lottery was rigged, these would be my candidates. Here's my list. Number one, Patrick Ewing, New York Knicks, 1985 with the 7 envelopes and whether they froze the side of one of them. It would have been the easiest one to rig, put it that way. Number two is the Kyrie Cleveland 2011 after LeBron went to Miami. Number three was the 2019. Thanks for trading Anthony Davis to the Lakers. Now here's Zion Williamson. Number four was thanks for buying the New Orleans basketball team. Here's young Anthony Davis as your prize. 2012. Number five was the 2014. Man, LeBron just needs one more asset and he might go back to Cleveland. We'll give them the number one pick. And then number six for me would be LeBron in Cleveland in 2003, sending him
home
back to Ohio, home versus sending him to Memphis. So I'm not saying the NBA rigs the lotteries. I'm just saying if we ever found out 60 years from now that there was more than one shooter for JFK and there was one rigged lottery, those would be my choices.
That was Bill Simmons reacting to the Dallas Mavericks winning the draft lottery with 1.8% odds last night. Congratulations to the Dallas Mavericks. Please take care of Cooper Flagg for me. You'll be quite pleased. But the conspiracy theories abound, Willie Donick.
It's just what's fun about sports sometimes.
Of course.
I mean, all facets of this. And Bill Simmons might be the best at articulating stuff like that. I mean, that's just, you know, what year was Patrick Ewing? 85?
Yes.
Something like that? I mean, that's going on 40 years.
He's a basketball historian.
40 years of history.
Yes.
In one take where he would have you believe that there are six times that they've rigged the...
I'm not saying it was rigged, but if it was, these would be the times.
Right, right. He's really good at that.
Yes, he is. A couple of texts on our Predators conversation. One texter says, I guess I'm confused on the goalie versus defenseman debate. If a goalie turns into Swiss cheese because of the defense, how can he also elevate the team when the defense plays well? To me, that's the defense elevating the team.
I think we're learning that the defense plays a big, big part of it. I think there was a time where you could be very shoddy defensively and a great goalie could erase a lot of mistakes. I think that's becoming much tougher to do in this day and age. The way teams have studied how to attack a goalie and where the quality areas on the ice are, I think they have a much better sense of that. It's kind of like the discovery of the three-point shot in the NBA. I think, A, there are better shooters. There are more good shooters in the NHL than there ever have been. And they know where you have to take the shots from. That's part of why you see less shots on goal, because everybody's looking for the high quality. And so no matter how good your defense, or no matter how good your goalie is, you will exploit that goalie if you get a certain amount of that quality. Cross ice completed passes, shots from the inner slot. Those are the types of terminology you're hearing now.
Yes.
This is relatively new stuff. So I don't think there are a lot of goalies out there that are Swiss cheese. There's a lot of really good goalies out there, but I still think there is something special about a small portion of the goalies. I still believe that UC Soros is in that category, but you have to play good defense. I think what happened to them this year, and Kevin Woodley, I think, articulated it, who studies goalies more than anybody that I know, you know, with the numbers to go with his observations. His theory was that UC Soros elevated the Predators until about, what did he say? On into December, maybe?
It was the first third of the season,
or so,
if I recall correctly.
He was playing well above. He was keeping the defense.
But they weren't scoring.
They weren't scoring. He was keeping them in games. And then his play leveled off because it's just so hard to overcome bad defense for an entire season.
Quickly, one texter, John in Nashville, says, a good offense/goal scorer takes the life out of another team. How many times in hockey games do you see a close game until two relatively close back-to-back goals are scored? The other team just looks deflated. That's sort of my point about the star-driven
league. Philip Forsberg has got that.
I wouldn't put Philip Forsberg on the same level as some of the other guys we were talking about, though. He has that capability, but I would not put Philip Forsberg on that in that same stratosphere.
As who?
As the Rantanens and Drysdales and McDavids and McKinnons of the world.
Yeah, but the Predators are never going to have that guy. I don't think, not anytime soon. I don't even think with the fifth pick in the draft they're going to get somebody. It's unlikely. I think they hope to have a guy maybe like Forsberg. I mean, those guys are important.
But yes.
You're talking about the top 0.1% of the league.
Mm-hmm.
Rantanen, McKinnon. Like, who would be in this category that you're talking about?
The top tier?
Yeah, the very, very top tier.
Drysdale, McKinnon, McDavid, Rantanen. I would put William Nylander in that mix, probably.
You would put Nylander, I'd say.
He might be
close.
On the cusp.
I'd say he's a level down from Rantanen, Drysdale, McDavid.
Right? Yeah, no. I would say he's probably on the line between the top tier and the second tier.
I would put Nylander maybe slightly above Forsberg, but not that far ahead.
We'll have to leave it here, but it is a
good... Predators need more, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. That'll do it for us today.
Oh, one second. Before we forget, today is Connor Newt's 21st birthday, so happy birthday, Connor.
Happy birthday, Connor. You're legal to drink, at least. That'll do it for us today. I will be on with Robbie Stanley tomorrow from 6 to 9 a.m. Willie and Derek will be on tomorrow from noon to 3 as we continue to shuffle the deck. But Chase and Big Joe is coming up next. On behalf of Derek Mason, be loved, love on your people. Have a wonderful Tuesday. Peace.